Hey everyone, this is Cody Turner. In this episode of TED Talks, I speak with Professor Michael Lynch. Dr. Lynch is the Board of Trustees Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of Connecticut. Professor Lynch has many accolades, and I'm certainly not going to do justice to his full bio here. Among other things, he is the Director of the Humanities Institute at the University of Connecticut, and the Director of the New England Humanities Consortium. His work concerns truth, democracy, public discourse, and the ethics of technology. Professor Lynch's work has either appeared in or been profiled in magazines such as The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and Wired Magazine, among others. And he's also spoken at the TED Conference, on MSNBC, and many other television outlets as well. In this episode, I speak to Professor Lynch about his most recent book entitled Know-It-All Society: Truth and Arrogance in Political Culture. The book essentially explores how digital culture, and offline culture more generally, is fostering an attitude of intellectual arrogance among the American public, and having an overall detrimental effect on contemporary politics. I think that this book could not be more timely, and it's also worth mentioning that the book is geared towards a general audience. It's not a specialized philosophy book. I really enjoyed it, and think it's an extremely important book that everyone should go out and buy. I'm going to embed a link to where you can buy the book in the show notes, and I'll also include some links to some other content from Professor Lynch. I really enjoyed the conversation and appreciate the professor taking the time to have it with me. So, without further ado, I give you the philosopher of truth, Professor Michael Lynch.
Welcome to TED Talks on the Shelter from the Storm podcast network, a place to talk the rain away. With your host, Cody Turner.
There's a storm coming, Mr. Wayne.
In the book, you talk about how digital culture and offline culture more generally is impacting politics, and you emphasize at the beginning of the book that this is a human problem. It's not a technical one. How, you know, we can reimagine our digital platforms, but ultimately we're going to have to change our attitudes. And the attitude that you focus on a lot in the book is intellectual arrogance. So first, I thought you could just define what you mean by intellectual arrogance and talk about how it becomes tribal, how this attitude can become what you call tribal.
Okay, so intellectual arrogance is the attitude, and you're right to say that I call it an attitude, the attitude of thinking that your worldview is unimprovable by evidence or experience from other people. That is, it's the attitude that people have when you fall into thinking that you've got something all figured out, that you know, as it were, it all about that topic, or at least all that there really needs to be known about that topic, and that nobody has anything to teach you. That's arrogance. And that's, you know, I mean, we all can recognize that in our bad days as things that we can fall into. And it's a human attitude that we all have familiarity with in our daily life, right? So that itself is what I mean by intellectual arrogance, and I call it intellectual arrogance not because it's about the arrogance of intellectuals, although, you know, God knows intellectuals can be plenty arrogant, right? it's called intellectual arrogance because it's arrogance about matters concerning the intellect, about your opinions, about what you think you know, your worldview, as I say. And that attitude, as you pointed out in your question, I think is most dangerous when it goes tribal. And an attitude can go tribal when any attitude, any psychosocial attitude, and that's what I mean by an attitude, it's a psychosocial mental state, can go tribal when it becomes indexed to a particular group and or directed at a group. So contempt is something that linked to arrogance, for example, that we can often see as something that's tribal. One group has a attitude of contempt towards another group. And that too is a very dangerous thing and very much linked to this attitude of arrogance. Put it bluntly, when intellectual arrogance goes tribal, it becomes the attitude that we know more than they do. We have it figured out. They don't. And that, of course, supports a type of politics, a politics not just of us over them, but I mean us versus them, but us of us over them.
Right. Yeah. So in chapter two, you talk a lot about how digital culture is encouraging this know-it-all society or tribal arrogance. So I just thought I could we could run through just a couple of important concepts pertinent to digital culture. One quote that I like from the neuroscientist Molly Crockett, she says, if moral outrage is like fire, then social media is like gasoline. So one of the first terms that you discuss in this chapter is Google knowing. Mm-hmm. So first, what exactly do you mean by Google knowing?
So Google knowing is a concept that I've explored at greater length, just so listeners can get some context, in another book called The Internet of Us. And in that book, and in this book, I understand Google knowing as knowledge that is acquired via digital interface. So it's not just knowledge that's acquired on Google, although I call it that because, frankly, most of us, when we acquire knowledge via digital interfaces, are using either the platform that Google supplies itself or apps that are built on the Android platform. I mean, not to say that there aren't apps that are built on different platforms, but that's a highly dominant way for us to interact with information on the internet. And so it's useful to call it Google knowing. So the paradigm case, but not the only case of Google knowing, is looking something up on Google or asking Google a question. We if we're lucky, when we do that, we acquire information that's true and which is coming from a reliable source. And if all those things happen to fall into place, and as you know, they don't always, in fact, many times do not. But when they do, we could really call it knowing, and it's a particular type of knowing, Google knowing. I can say more about the epistemological details of this, but that's the basic overview.
Yeah, and I don't want to get dragged too far back into your past book, but one of the things that really hit home to me is how you explain how Google knowing is a kind of receptive knowledge, like perception, and that ultimately leads to us knowing more but understanding less. And one of the most fascinating things in your past book that stuck out to me is that experiment that you conducted where you set out to discover certain facts without using the internet at all and realized just how astoundingly difficult it was.
Yes.
What was one of the facts that you're trying to learn?
A couple of them. I mean, so, there was one that was the easiest one to figure out was, not surprising, it was what was the capital of Bulgaria? All these questions I asked myself were real questions that I wanted to actually know the answer to. Mm-hmm. And that one was easy to figure out without the internet because in my case, I had an old atlas that was still up to date enough, book in my house, and I was able to look it up, no problem there. But then, more difficult questions like I wanted to know the phone number of my local congressional representative, right? That should be easy enough. So, of course, you might think you call information if there even is such a thing. But, of course, anybody that you talk to is going to just look it up on the internet. So that's not allowed by the rules of the game. So I couldn't ask anybody because they were just going to look it up on the internet. So I went to the local library for that one, thinking they might have this thing that used to exist called phone books. These were these books that had numbers in them back in the day. I think the Romans first used these. And I asked the kid behind the counter, I need the number for my local congressional representative. And he says, he didn't even look up. He's like, yeah, computers are over there. And I said, no, you don't understand. I can't use the internet. he looked him up and was like, oh, boy, here we go again. That old crazy guy. And... I mean, that's one. And then one last example is, and this is the one that really hits home. I wanted to know I was going to Austin, Texas, and I wanted to know a good restaurant there. So I wanted to know what's the best reviewed restaurant in Austin, Texas right now, not like a year ago.
Right. Up to date.
That's a question you wouldn't even ask without the internet. I mean, there are travel books and stuff like that, but they're not going to give you the answer to that question because they're like a year out of date by the time you get them. So that is a question. They're literally what that exercise showed me is that Google knowing is so sunk into the very fabric of our epistemological life right now that there are questions that we wouldn't even have entertained as answerable or even reasonable to pose that now we take for granted, and we take for granted that we can get those answers. And that's a great thing. That's a plus, the plus side of Google knowing. As you know, I think there are lots of not so plus sides.
Yeah, and one of the not so plus sides is this problem of algorithmic filtering that you talk about, how a lot of these algorithms are tailored to discern our patterns of online behavior and then give us content that matches our preferences. And that can lead to the creation of these epistemic bubbles and echo chambers where it's just giving you the information that you want, right?
Exactly. So in the new book, I particularly emphasize this point. Everything that we encounter on the internet, from the news that comes down our Facebook feed to the ads that we read, is tailored to fit our unique preferences that have been tracked via our previous interactions on the digital platforms and the apps that we use on our phone.
Right.
And that's fantastic, right? When you're shopping for a movie to watch, right? To have, you know, it be the case that the various platforms that you're interacting with are supplying the answers. In some cases, you might not even know that you want it.
They know your mind better than you do.
Exactly. After all, Google can complete our sentences with Google Complete. Does it all the time, every time you search. So that's great when we're shopping for shoes or books or movies. But it's not so great when you're shopping for facts, because when you're just getting the facts that fit your pre-existing opinions, that's a recipe for inflating your bubble, not for bursting it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to get into the concept of information pollution and this idea that social media is what you call a shell game. So just to quote you, you say, "Information pollution is the dumping of potentially toxic information into the media environment. Information can be toxic in different ways, but the most obvious ways are being false, intentionally deceptive and misleading, or simply not based on evidence at all." So first, could you just describe the distinction maybe between lying and deception? Because I feel like that's kind of an important distinction that stuck out to me. And then talk about how social media is a shell game in the way that you describe.
Sure. So you're right. The distinction between lying and deception is important because one can obviously lie. That is, say something that you know is false with the intention of deceiving, without actually deceiving, right? I mean, somebody can lie to you. This happens, you know, and you could be like spotted a mile away and be like, "You're lying to me." So you weren't deceived, right? So you can be somebody, you know, there's can be lying without deception.
Right. So deception is a success term.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But of course, there can also be deception without lying. Again, lying is saying something that you know you believe to be false with the intention of misleading. But I can deceive you without ever A, saying anything to you. I can deceive you by just, you know, pointing in a different direction. I can also deceive by saying nothing, right? I mean, this is a frequent way that deception is like not saying anything, right? And then, you know, later back and say just not supplying some information that you needed at a particular moment, right? Mm-hmm. In order to hide the truth from you is deception. Another way of deceiving, and this is the way that I talk about, I think is often very common on the social media and the internet in general, is that you can become deceived by simply confusing. You can being confused. And so I can deceive you by simply confusing you, by getting you to a point where you don't know what to believe. I may not have any particular view about what's true or false, but I can deceive you from, that is, prevent you from knowing the facts by simply, as a game, moving things around so quickly that you're not sure where the penny is, on which shell, right, is hiding the penny. And it's not that you believe something false, it's just that you don't know what to believe.
And that's that you've just described the epistemological predicament that I feel like I'm in, because I'm trying to make an effort to digest new sources from both sides of the aisle, you know, so like I'll listen to both sides of the aisle. But the more I do that, the more confused I get, because both of the sides of the aisle just seem to be operating completely different informational universes. So it's not, I feel like there's no common ground that I can, increasingly there's no common ground that I can find between the two different political sides. So I'll just, you know, flip from one universe to the next, and they're so far apart that I just don't even know what's true anymore. And so it's like the more bipartisan I try to get, the more confused I get in a weird way. And I don't know how to solve the problem.
I think that is a huge problem. I mean, you put yourself on one of the really big challenges to not just our democracy, but many democracies around the world right now. You're no doubt, I mean, the last few weeks, Gaudi, with the impeachment, have really brought this epistemological problem into really stark relief.
Yeah.
I mean, for anybody that's spent some time flipping back and forth between, let's say, Rachel Maddow and Sean Hannity, or just Fox News and CNN, the description of what's happening actually in the impeachment process, just the actual facts of what is happening are radically different. And of course, even when the description of the actual events are not different, the interpretation of consequences of those events are radically different. And, you know, this is a big problem for a lot of people. Now, it's true that a lot of people are not also in a different sort of issue, right? We've talked about two different problems. One is, for a lot of people, they're just happily in their bubble, right?
Yeah. And it would be easier if I could just consume one side. I would be so certain.
They're busily, right, helping to construct their bubble via the preference building nature of the internet, right? The algorithms, together with their own preferences, are just further and further, making their bubble stronger and more impervious to outside popping, as it were. So that's one problem. The problem that we're talking about now is for when people actually do try to get outside of their bubbles self-consciously, and they begin to realize that, wait a second, there's all these bubbles, and they're sort of opaque, and I don't know which one, you know, I really don't know which of them hides a reliable mechanism or not. I mean, I think there is, that is a reliable source. I think, you know, for a lot of, you know, in the case of, say, politics, I think the thing that people need to do is to realize, is to not just think about watching both sides, but trying to figure out how, let's say, different sources, right, came into being, what their motivations were, and whether, for example, those sources and their claims can be verified by other sources, right, that, let's say, may not be have the same motivations or financial incentives. So that's a long, complicated way of, let me give you an example, or your listeners an example.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve Bannon, former White House chief of staff, all around right wing troublemaker, essentially, is currently started up a podcast in the basement of his house, which is about the impeachment.
Mm.
And he's claiming to supply the facts about impeachment from the basement of his house. Now, I think it's not going to take a rocket scientist to know that whatever you think, whether you're a Trump supporter or not, maybe Steve Bannon might have some ulterior motivations. And motivations that are not completely oriented towards presenting a objective view of this matter, right?
Yeah.
In fact, not as much even as, let's say, take the Fox News. I'm not talking about Sean Hannity, but actually just the news on Fox or the news on CNN. But obviously, those two sources have pretty distinct political filters. But in the case of both of those news organizations, or the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, very, very very conservative, New York Times liberal. The thing is, however, is that they do have some motivation to try to present some type of objectivity, where Steve Bannon has no motivation at all. He doesn't have the fact, because those organizations I just mentioned are hoping to persist even after Trump is dead and gone, right?
Right.
And all of us, right, us are you know, technology changes. They have motivations to try to keep up their reputations. I'm not saying that they do a particularly good job about that, but notice that somebody like Steve Bannon or Breitbart or the Daily Stormer or et cetera, these sorts of sites are not, they're motivated purely out of political considerations. And those are things that your listeners really need to keep in mind. So I hope that was a long digression, but I hope it was helpful.
Yeah, no, it's very helpful. So in addition, so we've been talking about information pollution and how that can kind of encourage this know-it-all culture. Another way that digital culture can encourage this kind of intellectual arrogance is via what you call emotion sharing, right? So you talk about how it's a really interesting hypothesis. Most people think that the primary function of sharing content on social media is to make assertions or to transfer knowledge between their friends. But as you say that, no, actually the primary function is to share emotions such as outrage and stuff like this. And you talk about how many different things can have different functions, right? So one really helpful analogy for me in the book is this basketball analogy with people shouting air ball, right? If someone shouts air ball, the primary function of that is to distract the person who's shooting the free throw. But right. It could have other functions as well. It could accurately describe what actually in fact happened. Someone shoots an air ball. It could be a prediction, right? So there are many different functions that things have, and then there's the primary function. You say, like, yeah, maybe making assertions is one function that sharing content on social media has, but the primary one is emotion sharing. What's your evidence for that claim, or what makes you think that that claim is true?
So before I answer the great question, and before I answer the direct question about what the evidence is, let me just add a little bit more context about what I'm sharing. I think you described it beautifully, but just so people are clear, the sort of content that you and I are talking about right now is the sharing of news content, or at least content that is purporting to be news.
Right.
So I limit my attention to that. I mean, one reason for that is because it's pretty obvious that for things like when we share pictures of each other, right, or we share pictures of kittens, right, we're pretty much engaging in not really testimony or assertion, but that's like on the surface, obviously emotionally balanced, right? I mean, that whole point is to make each other laugh or, you know, provoke some other sort of emotion, like aw, right? You know, or something like that. So you know, the claim that I'm making wouldn't be interesting if we were talking about that stuff. The reason it's interesting, as you said, is that on the other hand, when we're sharing some story we read which is what's relevant to when we're talking about, let's say, the issue of fake news, we're talking about when we're sharing those things, what we think we're doing is engaging in what philosophers sometimes call testimony. That is, we're testifying to the veracity or at least the interest of this particular piece. We're recommending it or asserting that it's justified or plausible or something. So just as you said.
Yeah.
So why do I think that's not really what we're doing? Well, I think the evidence splits into two parts. One part of the evidence has to do with what we don't do online with this news content that we share, and the other thing has to do with what we do. So what we don't do is we don't tend to read what it is that we share when we share these stories. So recent studies that I talk about in the book indicate that at a minimum, 60% of the items that are shared on the internet are not read by the people that are sharing. Now, in fact, I think a lot of people, when I talk about this, lots of times, and some listeners may be shocked. Really? Because some people actually do read what they share. Newsflash, most people don't. And of course, a lot of people, when I share this, will say, well, duh, I bet you the number is actually much higher, right?
Yeah.
And it could well be very high that In fact, people rarely read what it is they're sharing. Even if you define, and this is the interesting thing, even if you define reading in a really loose way, like just clicking through to the article and spending, let's say, a second or two on it.
Which is, they don't even click on the link.
Yeah, well, yeah. So lots of people don't even click on the link. And some people, you know, if you define, for a number of the studies that are done on this, reading is defined as clicking through and spending some amount of time, very small amount of time, on the page.
Okay.
So it really means reading in this context sort of means what, you know, a lot of college students might mean when they say they read the article.
Okay. Very loose definition.
I mean, not busting on it, you know, but you know.
Yeah.
So what we don't do is we don't read what we're sharing. If we were engaging in this type of testimony, right? You know, if we were really actually seriously recommending item of information to people, you would think we would read what it is we were. It's hard to testify to something if you don't know what it is you're testifying to, right? Mm-hmm. A basic piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence is that what concerns what we do with this information. What we do is we tend to share items that are provocative, emotionally provocative. The evidence for that is actually it's quite large. There's a lot of evidence to suggest from all sorts of sources. This suggests that one of the best predictors, and in some ways the best predictor, of whether an item will be a post will be shared or retweeted is that the post contains emotionally provocative and particularly morally emotionally provocative content. Either
that kind of language will get more clicks.
Exactly. And I think any of us that spend time on social media know this. Right. I mean, it's not, again, rocket science. You know, like people who spend time on social media, which is most people now, you know that if you want to get your piece shared or retweeted, you got to, you know, saying something outrageous is going to help out.
Yeah.
Saying something like this, this is a very interesting article that raises some very subtle points. That's not so much like, you know, but saying something like, this politician is a killer, right?
Right.
Share if you agree, right? Right. That'll
get people's attention.
Right, I'll get people's attention. And so, you know, but particularly important are these terms, especially with regard to news items. The news items that get shared are those that where the posts include some sort of term that that produces outrage. So terms like murder, for example, right?
Yeah.
Those are powerful, morally, emotionally salient terms for us. When we see those sorts of words, we react to them in an emotional way. And so what does that suggest? Well, that suggests that if you put those two pieces of information together, that we don't read what we're sharing, and when we do share are things that get us emotionally riled up, what that together, I think, suggests is that this hypothesis is heading in the right direction. That actually what we're doing when we're sharing these news items is not engaging in testimony, but actually engaging in emotional expression in a way that, or at least to put it more precisely in the way that you did and I do in the book, that the primary function of sharing these news items is to is expressive rather than descriptive.
Yeah. So, and another piece that's related to all this is a lot of these social media sites are designed in such a way that they encourage the emotion sharing with the emoticons. You know, you can have the smiley face, you can have the frowny face.
Exactly.
A really interesting thought experiment that you laid out at the end of the chapter is, what if we reimagine the design features of these social media sites where instead of emoticons, we had something like justified by the evidence, not justified by the evidence, need more information? Maybe that would change the incentive structure in a way so as to encourage people to become more reflective. But in the end, you say, actually, I don't think this would really solve the problem just by changing the surface design features. Could you just say a little more about why that's the case?
Yeah, so that's an actual example that comes from, I actually made that suggestion to some executives of some digital platforms in an informal setting.
That's a good idea.
And I thought it was a good idea then too, but for reasons that I'll say in a moment, I'm not sure it would be hard to implement. And, but just to sort of give you a sense of what the reaction was, when I raised this suggestion in the setting that I did, the gathered experts there were, they thought I was hilarious. They thought I was making a joke. and they actually thought it was so funny that like one of them had gone to the bathroom, and when the person come back, they were like, say it again.
That's insane.
They thought it was so not yet. And so I think half of them thought I was just self-consciously making a joke. And then the other half thought I was so cutely naive that it was just, you know, hilarious. So actually I've come to think that they were right to laugh. So again, the suggestion would be replace the emoticons and the badges with justified by the evidence, not justified by the evidence, need more information. Those are the three choices. Now, the reason I think that's wouldn't work, or at least not for very long, is because if my hypothesis about emotional sharing is right, that the primary function of sharing these things online is to express our emotion, if I'm right about that, or that hypothesis were to pan out, then I think you would predict on the basis of that hypothesis that, and you could, I mean, this is an empirical question, but I would predict, I've been encouraging people to figure it out, but I predict that if we were to do that, that fairly quickly, those buttons would be start to be used in an expressive way rather than in a descriptive way. In other words, justified by the evidence would be start people would actually start to use it in a way to express yay this, right? Yay, right. And then boo, and sort of like indifference, right?
Right.
right, and no matter what the words were, that's how they would start to use those buttons, and you know, in much the same way that you know, airball, as you said, is primarily, I mean, airball, it doesn't really matter what the term is, right? You could shout anything. That's sort of, right? I mean, the term is not really, you know, that's why sometimes people just wave things, right? At the same time, so that the visual distraction is meant to distract the guy trying to shoot a free throw. The point is that the words can end up meaning one thing, but we can use them in an expressive way that isn't correlated with the way the words mean. So unfortunately, I think without redesigning the digital economy, the structure of the platforms, just merely making a fix like that is not going to help.
Yeah. So I guess that's, the fundamental problem is that the digital economy rewards emotion sharing. So we just need to reimagine like the very root of it in some way.
Exactly. I mean, think about Facebook. Facebook is not a platform that a lot of, you know, my daughter is 13. I mean, she doesn't use Facebook. That's for old people. But here, the fact is that Facebook is the dominant platform, right? Mm. It owns many of the other dominant platforms, right?
Right.
I mean, Twitter is tiny compared to Facebook, like a little bit, right? Facebook is the dominant social media platform. And so the reason I emphasize that is that, you know, if you're going to do this, you'd have to, it's Facebook that really is the thing that needs to change first. And one problem there is that Facebook on its face, what is their, you know, Zuckerberg's whole point in defending Facebook is he says Facebook is designed to connect us. That's its slogan. And what they mean by that is not connect us. They mean connect us emotionally,
mm-hmm.
what they want to do.
Right. Because
those are the strongest sorts of connections in the world.
Right. And
those are emotional connections between people are stronger than any other connection. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think what that suggests is that, you know, what we've got to start thinking about is the fact that if Facebook, which is also the place where a large plurality of the world gets its news, that we might need to start carving out aspects of Facebook that are news driven and those that aren't. We, you know, Zuckerberg needs to start realizing that he's the company, I think, which started out as purely emotional connections, has now become a news source for people.
Right.
But it's still operating by that emotional connection platform. And that is not a good combination. In fact, it's for reasons we've been discussing, a dangerous combination. And yeah. I think we've got to find a way to separate the one from the other.
Mm. Yeah, so we've been talking about, so I'm mindful now of your time. We've been talking about how social media can kind of encourage this kind of know-it-all society. So I just wanted to get your take on your discussion of convictions, and then maybe ask a question or two about the American right and the American left, which you sure. talk about in different chapters. So you talk about, social media can feed into this, but there might be something about the nature of conviction itself that encourages this know-it-all society. And you make a distinction between beliefs and convictions. And you talk about how oftentimes beliefs can be hardened into convictions and how debates about matters of fact can become politicized by becoming matters of conviction. And so first, I guess, what is a conviction before getting into the question of how beliefs can become hardened into convictions?
Right. So, I think this is in many ways the philosophical part of the book, and I'm glad that you asked me about it. I think that a conviction, to begin with, is not just a deeply held belief. As I say in the book, I deeply believe that, or strongly believe that 2 + 2 = 4, but it's not worth calling a conviction. A conviction is a commitment. It's action guiding. And it's particularly a commitment to something that reflects our self-identity. So our convictions reflect the kind of people we are aspiring to be, the kind of tribes we aspire to belong to. Notice I use the word aspire, because, of course, we might not live up to our convictions. That's a classic problem, right? You have the courage of your convictions. So your convictions are those principles, as it were, to those that reflect values that you see as things that you want to embody and exemplify. As I put it, the kind of person that you want to be. Another way of really putting it pretty crudely is your convictions reflect your self-image. And that's why, an attack on your convictions feels personal, because, it is.
Right. Okay, yes. And then so how is it that beliefs become hardened into convictions? And you talk about this in the political realm, both with respect to the right and the left. You talk about climate change in association with the right. You talk about beliefs about the benign nature of the Soviet Union in the mid-20th century on part of the left, and how both of these are examples of how beliefs have become hardened into convictions, and how if you are a member of the right, for example, you are not going to be maybe as rational when it comes to climate change, because you see any counter evidence that goes against your beliefs with climate change kind of as an attack on your identity in the way that you were talking about. Can you say more about that process?
Sure. So first of all, just one further point too that you just touched on is that part of this aspect of one of the most salient facts about convictions is that my convictions have an authority of sorts over what I believe. Because they reflect your self-identity, they make it, as it were, pragmatically rational or practically rational from the standpoint of self-interest, to push away evidence that runs counter to them. And that's a really important fact about convictions. The process in which Nietzsche said something really interesting about convictions. What he said was that convictions have a history, that what start out as convictions, what start out as passing opinions, can be hardened into convictions, as you put it. That process happens by a mechanism I call moral entanglement.
Right.
What I mean by that is that a belief, an opinion even, can get caught up in a particular narrative, a story, and often an ideological story about what the tribe represents. So, and once that happens, then almost any belief, no matter how on the face of it, empirical or just as a sort of matter of fact it is, can end up taking on this identity reflecting aspect of conviction. So you mentioned climate change. So the idea that climate change is a hoax or it's not real, that's a, you know, on the face of it, that's like saying that this bridge is unsafe, right? Or it's a straightforward matter, right, of empirical fact, right? Mm-hmm. Either the climate is changing or it ain't. Either the bridge is safe or it ain't. But given the right circumstances, that belief can, and in fact has, become a matter of conviction for people because they think via this process of moral entanglement that if you were to give it up, then giving that belief up, that conviction up, would end up undermining other aspects of this narrative or story that they are also committed to. So it's embedded into the web of their worldview, and cutting it out, it would have grave ramifications for other things they think are important for who they are. And a great example of that that you mentioned, and when I talk about in the book, on the left is, you know, the left's large part of the left was absolutely, you know, a matter of faith that the Soviet Union was, yeah, you know, it had its problems, but all things being equal, it represented a just form of government, particularly in the middle part of the 20th century. And as a result, you know, many intellectuals on the left refused to accept evidence that Stalin, for example, was massacring large parts of the Soviet populace.
Right. Okay, so in chapter, so just to talk a little more about the right and the left, and you give a chapter to each, right? So in chapter 4, you talk about the roots of authoritarianism in the American right and the Trump age. And in chapter, I think 5, you talk about identity politics. So I just have a question about each. I thought this discussion was extremely fascinating. So for me, I'm a liberal, but I come from a family that voted for Trump. And just to read a quote, so there are different narratives as to why Trump got elected. Some people think that it's mostly economic in nature. Other people think that it's cultural in nature, right? So just to briefly read a quote, you say, according to one side of the debate represented by political analyst Thomas Frank and others, a major reason that the Democrats lost the 2016 election is that they assumed people were supporting Trump only out of racism and sexism. The thought is that this assumption led to two fundamental errors. First, by dismissing Trump supporters as deplorables, to use Hillary Clinton's notorious phrase, progressive displayed an arrogant moral superiority that only served to galvanize the opposition. So for my family, that was the main reason. It wasn't, I don't come from the working class, so it was mainly the cultural aspect of it. But then there's also the economic narrative. And one point that I thought was very profound that you make is how this is a false dilemma. It's not that you have to choose between the economic and the cultural explanation for why Trump won. So what do you mean when you say that, and how does that tie into the broader point that you're making in that chapter regarding authoritarianism?
So let's start with authoritarianism. Hannah Arendt said rightly about 70 years ago in her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. She said that it's in the interest of mass leaders, so she sometimes would use that phrase, authoritarian leaders, to cultivate in their followers two attitudes, which are, their conjunction seems paradoxical, but really isn't. On the one hand, they want to cultivate in their followers a sense of anxiety, of feeling under threat.
And the other hand, security.
What's that? Insecurity. Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, they also want to cultivate in their followers a sense of superiority, a sense that in some sense, yeah, we're under threat, but really our side is got it figured out. We really are superior in some way. Now, that could be racial superiority or it could be cultural superiority. And usually that superiority is justified by appeal to a sort of glorious past. Jason Stanley calls it the mythic past. Now, why is that? Hold that in your head for a second, and let's return to the politics of today in 20th century or 21st century America. The reason that the choice between this debate that's been going on the left between, well, was it the economic explanation or was it the cultural one? That's a false dilemma, is because both of those really can be, both of those explanations can be subsumed under one larger umbrella explanation, which is that large parts of the American populace are, for one reason, feeling that they're under threat. They're feeling under threat. Now, they may actually be under threat, or they just may be perceiving that they're under threat. That the perception here is what matters, not reality. Yeah. Now, in some cases, that's because, you know, white people, for example, are some white people are worried about the fact that the demographics of the country are changing, that whites are no longer going to be, in a very short order, the majority of the country, of the electorate.
Right.
It's actually that is true. I mean, they're tracking the facts there, right? Mm. And so that can cause people to feel anxious, right? That demographics are changing, and that can lead to racial anxiety, which is the one explanation, right? Mm-hmm. But there's other sorts of threats as well, besides the demographics. Other threats are the changing of the economy. The economy has largely changed not just around the world, but certainly in particular in the United States, and we all know that. This is the sort of those changes in the economy and the rise of inequality, income inequality, is something that both Trump and Bernie Sanders, for example, were tracking, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the economic side, but that's a threat too, right? See, that also makes you feel anxious. One of the things that Trump was particularly good at was playing on people's anxiety, right? The thing about anxiety is it often becomes sort of free-floating, right? I mean, sometimes when you're in the middle of anxiety, political or otherwise, sometimes it's not really clear to you what the hell is making you anxious.
Right.
Because anxiety clouds your psychological profile. We all know this, right? Anytime you're feeling anxious, it's like one of the things that really sucks about it is because you're not, you know, it clouds your decision-making ability.
Well, in the philosophy of mind, some people think anxiety is a mental state that lacks intentionality. It's not about anything because right. It can be free-floating in this way.
Exactly. So, I mean, without getting into that debate,
yeah. You
just simply say that it is the case that anxiety is often clouds its source. And so if you have go back to now Hannah Arendt, who's saying that, look, authoritarian leaders throughout history have a deep motivation to cause anxiety in their followers, to not just cause it, of course, but often to reflect it. They'll see something that's really happening, and then they'll say, let's build on that, and let's provoke it and deepen it. And at the same time, let's tell people a story that says to them, I know you're anxious, but actually, if you follow me, the person who's telling it like it is, I can relieve your anxiety, and I can reassure you that you and our tribe really are deserving of special treatment or power or any other particular goal that a leader might want us to achieve.
Yeah. So pivoting now, so you don't just dissect the right, you also dissect the left. And so pivoting now to the left, another fascinating distinction that you make is this distinction between two kinds of identity politics, right? So you talk about how liberals are often seen as being arrogant and disdainful and emitting an air of moral superiority towards their opponents. And oftentimes that's linked to the fact of identity politics. But you make a distinction. You say, look, there are these two kinds of identity politics. There's a politics of recognition and a politics of tribalism. And oftentimes when people are talking about identity politics, they're implicitly or subtly conflating these two different kinds of identity politics. So could you just explain what that distinction is?
Sure. So most of the time when people are criticizing identity politics or sometimes even supporting it, they don't really often say what they mean by it. So that's one thing I think that in the general culture, the term is often not as defined as it should be in discussions throughout the general culture on the news, in the news media, for example. But in fact, identity politics is, there is a large literature of it, about it. But when you dig down into the literature, you realize that there really are two different types of things that people mean by identity politics. On the one hand, as you said, there's this idea that which I call recognition politics, which is the idea that you're engaged in recognition politics when you're engaged in advocating for recognition of your particular social group. That is recognition that the A, they exist, the social group is a category, B, that it deserves the same legal protections, for example, as other groups, and or, you know, fighting against oppression of that group. Recognition politics is a traditional part of democratic politics. It's not something that is born with the left or the right. It goes back as far as democratic politics really, I think, go back itself.
Because, right, and that's explicitly linked to democratic ideals. The goal is to make everyone more equal,
exactly,
as it applies to oppressed groups.
Exactly. It's just in general to try to recognize that everybody should be equal under the law, which is what, when we're talking politics, is what we mean by equality. We mean equal under the law, treated equally by the state. That's just, you know, caught up in democratic ideals. People mix that up with another idea, which is we call tribal politics, which is the idea that I'm advocating for my group to have supremacy over the other groups. Actually, I'm advocating for my group as in the same way I might advocate in a wartime situation. So tribal politics sees politics really as war by other means. It's about one tribe versus another tribe, and your role in politics is to, you know, beat the other tribe down and to gain power for yourself. That also has a long history. It goes back farther than democratic politics, so farther than recognition politics. It goes back, frankly, as far as human beings go back. And it has its advocates from Machiavelli on down the line as being something that, you know, is inevitable. But it's very, very undemocratic. And I think when we're thinking about identity politics, we've got to realize that the left has grave problems with arrogance. Its problem, though, is not in recognition politics. The problem that the left has is sometimes falling into tribal politics, which is something, by the way, the right also falls into. Mm-hmm. More problematically, I think, with the left, even than anything to do with identity politics of either kind, is that the left ends up thinking that, and I fall victim to this myself in previous work, very tempting for those of us on the left to think that we're the party, the brand of facts and rationality, that somehow we are immune from implicit bias and prejudice.
Right.
And we can rise above all these sorts of problems that other human beings fall into. We can't. And it's absolutely fundamentally problematic that sometimes the left talks as if we can.
Yeah, so I think that might link to the final question that I have just to end. And someone reading this might say, you telling us that we're being intellectually arrogant, we need to reflect upon our fallibilities. That's not right because at this moment in history, because that can encourage the intolerance. And you know, you say some people want to use your phrasing, you say some people want to, quote, resist the use of democratic means towards undemocratic ends by using undemocratic means for democratic ends, which I think is a natural impulse. Like, look, these people are taking advantages of the liberties that we have in the West to push intolerance. So maybe we should use undemocratic means to make sure that we can safeguard those liberties. But at the end, near the end of the book, you say this actually isn't the way to go because it switches respect for our fellow man to contempt. So I thought maybe you could just end articulating that a bit further.
Yeah, so I think this is a profound challenge that we're facing in our democracy and other democracies. There is no doubt that it's important right now to speak up against
proto-fascism against the rise of white supremacism, against the movements, violent often movements of nationalism moving around the globe. These are dangerous political movements, and protesting them, speaking up against them, and speaking out against them, as I'm doing right now, is absolutely politically, democratically essential from my point of view. On the other hand, I think that I am one of those philosophers, and this is a contentious issue in politics and political theory, but I'm one of those philosophers that with Dewey thinks that if we end up using undemocratic means for our democratic ends, our democratic ends will slowly slip away and become undemocratic, possibly without our noticing it.
I think I agree with that.
And I think that means that that puts us in a precarious situation, because it means that we may have to not, let's say, engage in certain types of actions that we might otherwise want to engage in. It puts us in a dangerous situation sometimes, because we may feel like it may happen that while we're trying to engage in be democratic, that the authoritarians and the nationalists win the day. I hope that that doesn't happen. But I also fear that if we end up refusing to reflect on ourselves, refusing to try to, reach for the angels of our better nature, we'll end up in a place that may be indistinguishable from the very dark place that we're trying to avoid now.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to end it. Thank you again. I'll attach a link to your book in the podcast description, and I think everyone should go read it, because I found it very helpful for me personally in navigating this crazy digital economy that we're all embedded in.
Thanks so much. Good talking to you, Cody.